and support volunteer at Bullen Middle School in Kenosha. Chuck Wolbers, a special education teacher with Kenosha Unified Successful Transitions for Exceptional Students Program, and Steve Brown, assistant professor of educational leadership at UW Oshkosh. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Good morning. I'm Dwayne Olson, your host today for Education Matters on WGTD HD Gateway Technical College, Kenosha, Wisconsin, at 91.1 on your FM dial, and 101.7 in Elkhorn, and 103.3 in Lake Geneva. WGTD is a member of the Wisconsin Public Radio Network. Before we begin, I want to indicate that this program was recorded a week ago. Our program today focuses on current issues in Wisconsin public education, with particular emphasis on urban education as found in Milwaukee, Kenosha, and Racine. My guest today is Mr. Alan Borsuk, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University Law School. Alan retired in 2009 from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel after 37 years, the last 10 of which he wrote about education. As part of his activity at the Marquette University Law School, he now writes a weekly column on education for the Sunday Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Welcome again to Education Matters. Alan, I think this is the fifth time that you've been my guest.
I haven't kept score, but I enjoy talking with you, and I appreciate the chance.
Okay, and I really like having you on because it gives our listeners then a little broader perspective, I think, on education in Wisconsin, plus focusing on MPS, Milwaukee Public Schools, which I think is a bellwether for us. Other urban school districts are smaller urban districts here in Wisconsin. So, Alan, let's get started. The big issue in the Milwaukee Public Schools these days seems to be the Milwaukee Public Schools and Opportunity Schools Partnership Program, this called OSPP, as adopted by the Wisconsin State Legislature. Remind our listeners what that is.
I'd be glad to if I can figure it out myself.
Yeah, therein lies the challenge. I've been reading the paper and trying to do the same.
Frankly, I'm not at all sure it was a well-thought-out idea at its origin, and it certainly hasn't been well played out since its origin. But in a nutshell, in the state budget that was passed a little over a year ago, June of 2015, at the initiative of State Senator Alberta Darling from lives in River Hills, Milwaukee suburb, and State Representative Dale Coanga, who lives in Brookfield, both Republicans, a provision was put in that allowed the Milwaukee County Executive to name a commissioner of the OSPP and who would have the power to take over several Milwaukee public schools, low-performing schools, each of the next few years and try to get better results than what they had. So the concept was MPS hasn't done well with these schools. Let's pretty much force someone else to come in and take it over. So conceptually, that's understandable. It's the practical side of it, of what the mechanism was for doing this, that got to be a mess pretty much right away. I think the county executive, Chris Abley, was given the power because the mayor of Milwaukee didn't want it, and I don't think the Republicans wanted him. And they didn't want to give it to the State Department of Public Instruction. So kind of by process of elimination, the county executive got it. But in pretty short order, he and the commissioner he named, who was Damon Means, the superintendent of schools in Mequon-Thiensville, just north of Milwaukee, both said they really didn't want to do anything that would, so to speak, hurt MPS. They weren't going to take away schools from MPS, which became a question, well, what are they going to do? MPS was adamantly opposed because of that, that losing schools meant losing students, meant losing money, meant losing power, meant losing all sorts of things. And MPS is in a rather fragile state. Dr. Means came up with a proposal in which, frankly, which I never understood entirely, in which one school would be designated to be part of the OSPP program, but it would still remain closely affiliated with MPS. The teachers would stay on. MPS would get the state aid that was involved. And he argued that this would cause the least damage to MPS, and it wasn't to take you over. It was a collaboration. The Milwaukee School Board and the Milwaukee Superintendent, Dr. Darian Driver, were adamantly opposed to this still. And there was very little communication between the two leading up to the kind of the climax of the plot at the end of June, when Dr. Means resigned from this unpaid position he was doing while still being superintendent of Mequon-Thanesville, and things just pretty much came to a halt. My own guess is they will stay at a halt until next spring, when the real action will begin, because that's when the legislature will take up the next state budget, and that's when all the cards get redealt, and the future of MPS will be very much on the line then. As an important development, right after Dr. Means resigned, the majority leader of the state Senate, Senator Scott Fitzgerald, said in a television interview that everything was on the table when it came to changes in MPS, restricting financial support for MPS, splitting up the district, creating new ways of taking things over. Everything's going to be on the table, and that is a potentially huge development, which, as I said, really won't play out till next spring, but the agitation and conversation about it behind the scenes is going on very actively, I'm told. There's lots going on, but not publicly at this point.
Okay, so right now it just seems like that things are at a standstill, and it'll probably wait until the legislature gets back in session before any action takes place for the future.
Under the law, the county executive, Milwaukee County executive, has 120 days to name a new commissioner, which would be near the end of October. He has not said anything publicly since Dr. Means quit a month ago, and I'll be surprised if he tries to do. I mean, it's just totally at a standstill. If there's no cooperation and no eagerness to force anything, and I'm not sure there's any momentum at all behind it. My guess is the Republicans themselves have pretty much thrown up their hands on this idea and are waiting to come up with a new one. But yeah, it's just a waiting game right now.
Are there any lessons that have been learned from this? I mean, are people learning something so that this sort of thing doesn't happen again? Because it really puts certainly MPS in kind of a tough situation.
Well, I certainly hope so, but I really don't know. To be honest, from my perspective, and I try to be not partisan about these things, but to be the kind of the color commentator in the booth watching the game on the field, it was not a well-thought-out idea. It had no public hearings before it was adopted. It was a hope and not really a plan. And things got worse from there. So if anything was learned, the first thing is try to come up with some ideas that are going to work.
Yes.
And this, I never thought had much hope of working. So beyond that, I think there was a serious question. How much can you force on a community?
Exactly.
Without any buy-in, without any consent. I mean, and no one in any sector of the Milwaukee school picture, which is still very divided and very complex. You got not only MPS, but a large private school voucher program, more than 27,000 students last year.
In the voucher programs?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's over 20% of all the publicly funded kids in Milwaukee.
Oh, my.
Kids who are getting their education publicly funded. And you've got a big charter sector. But no one wanted to do this. No one wanted to take over these schools. You know, that was one of the questions, is who's going to run these schools? So if you're going to have a practical idea, you have to have a practical sense of who's going to run these schools, what will make them better than what was going on before, who's going to teach in them, where the money's going to come from. One of the biggest flaws in the OSPP law was that it included essentially no funding. And you can't say, well, how are we going to pay for all of this? I mean, it included that the kids in an OSPP school would have gotten the state charter payment, which is actually less than what public schools get. But there was no money for extra services, and there was no money to pay the commissioner or his staff. Dr. Means did what is it, about 8 months worth of work, 7 months worth of work, best as I know, for free, which I found quite amazing.
Yes.
But if you're gonna drive the car somewhere, there has to be gas in the tank, and there was no gas in the tank for this idea.
And it just makes me wonder if Alberta Darling and the people who worked with her had found any models that they wanted this to follow, or just came up with something that they thought seemed reasonable.
Well, it's sort of modeled after what happened in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina in 2005, where they took actually what existed before the hurricane, which was called a recovery school district, in which the state was taking over a small number of schools, and grew that into essentially eliminating the public school district in New Orleans and making all the schools charter schools. But it took an enormous amount of effort, time, patience, and you could still have huge arguments with people as to what degree it's paying off. Similarly, there's been a modified, not quite on the scale of New Orleans, but plans in Memphis, which may or may not be paying off again, depending on who you listen to. Even Detroit, there's been attempts to take over schools and turn them over to private operators. Philadelphia, there has been. They've all been controversial. In some cases, you can say, yeah, this school is better, or this group of schools is better, but it's unclear what the total lesson is. So it was an attempt to have a small-scale version of those plans. But those plans all took a lot of resources, and even at that, difficult times getting any success.
Right. Okay, well, thank you for your analysis of this. And I think that this gives our listeners then a better sense of this challenge, I guess, and then in terms of also what needs to be done as we move into the future. Let's move on. Let's suppose that Governor Walker has agreed to be interviewed for one or more upcoming articles on education. What are some issues that you would raise in this interview with Governor Walker, and why those issues?
Oh, what an interesting question. I admit I haven't spoken to the governor in a long time. I haven't tried. He's usually not. In some situations, he's accessible, but for a sit-down interview, he doesn't do too many of those. If I were interviewing him, I think so many things have been tried, including things in his coming up on 6 years as governor. And they paid off so little. So why, in terms of improved student achievement, so why is that? What isn't working and what needs to be done that would work? That would be the broad question. And it's certainly not a question that's addressed in the Republican national campaign this year. Donald Trump has effectively no education platform except that he's pro-choice and anti-Common Core. And that isn't really a platform. It's
right.
It has no specifics at all. I think I would certainly want to talk to him about whether he thinks public schools as a whole need an increase in the what's called the revenue cap that the state has actually had since 1993 or 4, as I recall, which limits the amount of state aid and property tax revenue any public school district can get. That revenue cap went up steadily through the 90s and the 2000 to 2010 period, actually slowed down at the end of Governor Doyle's time as governor because the state budget was in worse shape, but it's been effectively halted. It was cut under the Act 10 legislation in 2011, and it's been kept essentially flat since then. And public districts all across the state, rich, poor, urban, rural, suburban, are really feeling a squeeze. Just ask any district, 424, I believe it is, districts in Wisconsin, if you could find four of them that said we're not having financial problems, I'd be very surprised. So in the coming state budget, the one that'll be done in the spring of 2017 for the next 2 years.
Yes.
Does that floor need to be lifted? Public school people certainly want it to be. Second big question I would ask, and I think it's going to be a big issue in the budget, is we now have a statewide private school voucher program. it's got some limitations on it that are tighter than the programs in Milwaukee or Racine, particularly related to who can qualify. The family income cap for the state program is lower than for Milwaukee and Racine.
Right.
So what does he see as the future for the state voucher program, and is it going to grow? And if it's going to grow, which I'm sure a lot of Republicans would like, what's going to be the consequences of that? And then my question on any voucher program, you've got some really, really good schools, let's say in Milwaukee and in Racine. You got some schools that are much weaker and certainly aren't doing any better than the surrounding public schools. What can be done to get more quality in all of the sectors in Wisconsin, public, charter, but the one that's least controlled now is vouchers.
Okay. Is there any voucher program across the country that is doing well, proving itself to be the answer in terms of funding education in our society?
Boy, that's a good question.
I don't think I've heard of any.
Well, it depends a little bit on who you ask. There's certain researchers, frankly, generally identified as pro-voucher, who say the evidence is really very clear that kids who went to private schools on publicly funded vouchers graduate at a higher rate, go to college and succeed in college at a higher rate. And there are certainly cases where that's true. How sweeping that generalization is, I don't know. At best, the evidence is that there's some mildly positive results, but it's pretty incremental. And around here, around Milwaukee, Racine, there really aren't any results so far in the state program, which is quite new. For the most part, if you really boil it down to general terms, the voucher schools aren't doing any worse, and they aren't doing any better. And there are studies around the country where that's generally true. Now, that said, they are very popular. People like having choice.
Yes.
People like sending their kids to private schools, the people who are doing it. So there's no question they're popular.
Is it some race involved in this? Because that's sometimes what I suspect is people are trying to get away from their kids away from people who are different than they are. Do you have any sense for that?
I don't think that's particularly any better or worse in the private sector than it is in the public sector. The same is true in the public sector. Why do people live where they live? The most pervasive form of school choice in America is buying a house.
Yes.
And you choose your community. You choose it oftentimes with a major eye towards the schools in the community. And segregation by race is so pervasive. And that's certainly true in Wisconsin. It's true in the Milwaukee area. It's true in the Racine area. I assume it's true in Kenosha, but I don't know the patterns in Kenosha as well. And so people choose to send their kids to schools of almost entirely one race by where they live. And that's true in the case of Milwaukee. That's true not only for white families, but for black families and Hispanic families. You have very few schools in the Milwaukee area that I would call integrated. There are some, and I applaud them. And some of them even have done it intentionally, both public and charter, and maybe a few private ones. They really set out to be a, shall we say, United Nations school. But you name a school for me in the Milwaukee area, and I'll tell you it's predominant race almost always within 2 seconds. I know right away, this is a black school, this is a white school, this is a Hispanic school. Some of which are excellent schools. And there's very little impulse, there's very little momentum or advocacy for integration these days.
Interesting. Yeah, that's interesting. And certainly at the Republican convention last week that we heard is choice was the big solution to education's problems, and this, of course, responds to that.
Well, the only reference Mr. Trump made in his acceptance speech, and if you go on his website going back 6 months, his entire education platform is something like a 53-second video clip. I've watched it. And the only reference he made in his acceptance speech was that every parent should be able to send their child to a grade school of their choice. And he emphasized that last three words. So, yeah, people do it all the time, but they do it by choosing to live in the community they live in. And that means if you got the money, you move to a Brookfield or a North Shore suburbs in Milwaukee or further out into, you know, Maguanago, Muskego, Kettle Moraine, Arrowhead, those districts in western Waukesha County, which are, to this day, almost 100% white.
Right. Okay, let's move on from that, too, and thank you for your analysis of this, because this is certainly a challenge then facing Wisconsin public education as well as much education across the country. You've had an opportunity to meet with many educators in writing your weekly columns as well as your other work at Marquette University. What do you see as the quality of public school educators these days, teachers and administrators? And I know you wrote a column a year or so ago about we need more high-quality principals, and I really like that column.
And that's something I still would certainly feel strongly about.
Uh-huh.
I have an enormous amount of respect for how hard the work of a teacher is, and how hard teachers work. I think it's not only a myth, but a very harmful myth that teaching is easy. Oh, you get summers off and you only work 5 hours a day and all that. I think that's baloney. As far as the overall demands of the job. And the people who do it are almost always doing it out of dedication and eagerness to succeed for their kids. That said, I don't think there's any reason not to hold by that and also hold by wanting to find out ways to get better teachers in classrooms and improve the skills of the teachers that are there. How do we get the best and the brightest to go into this field? I think harm has been done to that in Wisconsin by bad mouthing of teachers in the last half dozen or so years, which correlates, I suspect, with the passage of Act 10 in 2011, but that's not the only factor, and it existed before that. Simply respecting the profession of teaching would help encourage people to go into it if teachers felt more supportive, and they have reasons to feel not supported, and it's not just money and benefits. But also just to pay is a factor, how to make it an attractive profession, something you want to stay in. The emphasis on principles is crucial because, to be honest, and I think this is especially true in schools with the more challenging populations, which is to say populations where historically his success isn't so great, low income, high minority schools, that those schools need really strong leaders, teachers who just, principals who just galvanize a school, who can get everybody in working as a team and united and energized. And such people exist. But it requires, you know, a real A or A minus type principal, and we have a lot of B and C principals. They're not bad, but they're just not getting that school culture thing together as much as they should. And I wish we'd focus on that. If you had a great principal, the odds that you'd end up with great teaching are just so much higher because everyone unites and you can create a climate in which people are working together, teaching gets better, people are much more likely to stay on because they feel supported and rewarded.
Right. I was in a high school in Racine this last week, and I was impressed with the new principal in that high school. It strikes me that he might be one of those A principals that you're talking about. It'll be interesting to follow his career now in the next couple of years.
I'm all in favor of that. I'm always excited when I hear about people like that, and I've seen it. I've been in schools where it's going on. You say, hey, these people are great, and especially if you give them 2 or 3 or 4 or 6 years or something, it you see the results. The school just gets moved up a bunch of notches.
Exactly. It gets a personality of its own, and it spreads.
And it so often starts with the principal. It isn't a one-man, one-woman show by any means.
Exactly.
But there is a spark plug, and it's almost always the principal.
Okay, and it has to be a person who can see the strengths of his or her fellow teachers and that sort of thing, and maximizes those opportunities for those people.
It's an odd thing. I've seen principals that I thought were terrific and were getting terrific results who had much different personalities than other principals who also earned that kind of description. You know, some of them were very effective at running the business of the school. Some of them were more visionary. I remember one principal I observed many times over the years who was just, if you met him, you thought he's just this kind of old schmoozy kind of guy, and I don't even sure he works very hard, except his school was going at full speed and in difficult circumstances. And most tellingly, when he retired, the school went downhill almost immediately.
Isn't that interesting? And so sad.
Yeah. 100% agreed.
My oldest grandchild is a teacher, and she was a principal in a Madison suburb school, this elementary school, is from May 1st to the end of the school year, and it's her first experience in doing any principaling. She was the second person as a principal, and she said she had never worked so hard in all of her life.
That's actually a really interesting issue because it's a hugely difficult, demanding, 24-hour-a-day job. And in general, principals are paid pretty well, but the differential between being a veteran teacher and being a principal isn't that great in a lot of places. You say, what's the incentive to be a principal? And I don't think it's money alone, but money is part of it. They say, man, we have to make it so that people want to do these jobs.
Exactly, yeah. I was on the Racine School Board in the early 90s, and one of my little mantras was, is it a manageable task? Because I think so many tasks in education aren't manageable.
And I think you'd find an awful lot of educators who would say it's only gotten worse that way because this is statistically demonstrable, that the level of poverty among students statewide in Wisconsin has gone up quite dramatically over the last 20 years. I don't remember the numbers offhand, but it's pushing towards 50% of all students in the state are, might even be over 50 now, qualify for free and reduced price lunch. And the correlation between income and success in school is unfortunately strong. That doesn't mean it's destiny for any single child. There are kids coming from low-income homes who do great. There are certainly kids coming from high-income homes who do terrible. But nonetheless, the overall correlation is pretty strong. And across the economic, socioeconomic spectrum, family problems, quality of home life, whatever, these things are, I think it's statistically demonstrable that they're not what they used to be.
Exactly. They're more challenging.
You know, just whether it's eating dinner together most days or a two-parent household or any number of factors you want to point to, there's a lot of troubles out there in the homes where children are living, and they show up in school.
Let's continue this idea of quality educators and that sort of thing. Do you have any sense of a difference in educator quality between the public schools and private and parochial charter schools? Is there any difference, or are they pretty much the same people?
That's a really interesting question. I think it's an important question. I think to this day, it's still probably true that public school teachers tend to be more experienced. The public schools pay better than the private schools. For a long time, the Catholic schools throughout southeastern Wisconsin tried to maintain 80% pay of compared to the surrounding public school districts, and I think they felt that the sense of mission and maybe the warmth of the school or whatever, small sizes of schools and classes would help compensate, so to speak, for the missing 20%. But nonetheless, it's pretty common for people to start out in private schools because there's more jobs, and then to look for a public school job because even post Act 11, the pay's better, the benefits are better. There's more variation from school district to school district probably than there used to be because the restraints of teacher contracts have been not eliminated, but they're much weaker now than they used to be because of the changes in state law six years ago now. So in any case, I think you'd find younger, less experienced teachers overall in private schools and to some degree charter schools. Is the quality worse? I don't know. The sense of mission is very high in all of those sectors.
And I'm thinking too, are these private parochial charter schools, are they the proving ground maybe for the public schools in terms of securing teachers?
Well, every school that has, every new teacher learns a lot in the first few years on the job. I've never heard anything that suggested anything other than that. The first couple years are very developmentally important for a teacher, especially when it comes to learning classroom management, just what works with kids and how you try to maintain order. So any school or school district that has a disproportionate number of new teachers is going to be a training ground in large part. And that includes that it certainly historically and anecdotally clear that a lot of teachers who teach in the city of Milwaukee, frequently in very challenging circumstances, then migrate to the suburbs. I have a friend who just told me he's doing that a couple weeks ago, that he's leaving a very troubled Milwaukee high school for a much more academically successful suburban high school. So it happens in the public sector. One of the things in the post-Act 10 world is that there's lots of anecdotes. I think the actual data suggests it's not as big a deal as it might seem. But public school districts, there's like an open market now and a very competitive market. So even some of the more prestigious suburban schools are losing some of their star teachers to other suburban districts because there's a bidding war. And you hear, you know, this district has a really good computer teacher or math teacher, some of the areas that are in high demand, and you go pick them off, and you can give them salary offers tailored to that. We'll pay you $10,000 extra to come teach in District X. And I know one of the South Shore Milwaukee districts, the superintendent told me not too long ago, they were losing it into more of a blue-collar community, a little more blue-collar success rates, shall we say. I mean, it's not quite as college-bound. He said they were losing a lot of their best teachers to very much college-oriented K-12 districts out in the more affluent areas of the Milwaukee area.
Okay, let's at this point, I want to remind our listeners that this is your host, Dwayne Olson, and you're listening to Education Matters on WGTD HD at 91.1 on your radio dial from Gateway Technical College, Kenosha, Wisconsin. Today I'm visiting with Alan Borsuk, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University Law School, and about current developments in Wisconsin public education with emphasis on urban education. Before taking his position at Marquette, Mr. Borsuk wrote on education for the Journal Sentinel and currently writes an education column for the Sunday Milwaukee Journal. Now back to our program. You were talking about the open market for teachers, so under Act 10, and that school districts then that have less resources are losing many good teachers or some good teachers then to other districts that can pay more.
One other aspect of this is nationwide, there's growing concern about, to use the jargon in the business, the teacher pipeline, who's going into teaching and whether we have enough upcoming teachers. The Public Policy Forum, which is a research organization, nonpartisan organization in Milwaukee, did a very thorough look at the the teacher supply, particularly in the Milwaukee area, but also with some statewide figures that came out about 2 months ago. And it wasn't super alarming, but the trend of reduced enrollment in teacher education programs in Wisconsin, the reports of what was going on in school districts as far as recruiting teachers, were getting to be more concerning, and it was pretty easy to look at this and say, there's a good chance we have growing problems coming in the next few years of simply finding teachers, which also carries implications for finding top-notch teachers.
Right. And, you know, one of the things that tends to happen when these shortages occur is the standards for becoming a teacher then are lowered.
Well, I don't think we're ever going to get to the point where you're not going to have candidates for jobs, at least not in large numbers, because they're still pretty good jobs, and jobs are tight, and somebody's going to want them. But are they really the pool of people that would be most ideal? You know, the countries that have reputations for top-notch education systems, people for years have been pointing to like Finland and Singapore and places like that, the teachers are coming from the top third of the college classes in those countries.
Yes.
And the job of being a teacher is treated as a really prestigious occupation. Teachers are almost revered in some countries, which isn't the case here.
Yeah, it's
you know, you can overstate how much teachers are not treated with respect, because many people still do that.
Yes.
But nonetheless, it's not like, you know, the profession you might brag about to your friends.
Yeah, culturally, yeah, somehow we've gotten into that mode, and then somehow have never gotten out of it.
Which is too bad.
Which,
and,
yeah,
and pay a price for it.
Yes. Okay. And along with the income for teachers, Wisconsin public school teachers and most public employees, except for police and fire, now have several years of functioning under Act 10, whereby they are limited to salary increases that supposedly do not exceed the cost of living. However, I've read of school districts giving additional remuneration through other approaches, such as merit pay and additional assignments. What are some of the approaches, and how extensive are they?
To be honest, I don't know how to answer that. I wish I knew the answer.
Uh-huh.
A friend of mine is working on a project, a news project, that may provide some of those answers that I think is coming in a number of weeks ahead here. There are districts that are experimenting more with merit pay. Merit pay, you know, let's pay good teachers more than we pay bad teachers.
Yes.
Conceptually, that sounds like a great idea. But this isn't baseball. You don't have earned run averages and all that kind of thing. You say, hey, this guy is a pitcher who won 20 games four seasons in a row. That doesn't happen in teaching. It's just so hard to determine actual merit. Everyone wanted to use data to show, oh, in this class, kids move ahead much faster than other classes. Every research report and I've read, and some of them have been projects that were very thorough and well-designed and you know, blind studies and neutral and all this stuff has shown it doesn't really work that way. You can't pick a teacher who so easily in most subjects and say, this is your star teacher and this is your not-so-star teacher. Let's pay the one better. So that's tough to do. There are some experience with that, and most of it is based on observations, and some of it may be unfair and some of it may be very fair. I think you're seeing more of providing incentives for fields in which it's hard to get teachers, which would largely be things like math and science at the high school level, bilingual education, special ed jobs, special ed teaching, those jobs are harder to fill and they're very grinding oftentimes, so the turnover is high. So in some of those fields, there are districts that are paying premiums to get people. In many ways, Act 10 changed a lot. It gave administrators and principals more freedom to assign teachers and move people around and change schedules, which administrators generally think they're much better off this way and are much better able to respond to what kids need. But the actual power of contracts, pay, benefits, and such, in many ways hasn't changed as much as people thought. Most districts are still kind of doing what they did in the traditional contract era, just maybe a little less formally. They have handbooks now instead of contracts, but that spell out like teacher rights and grievances and so on. And the handbooks in many districts, Milwaukee's a really good example, are not much different than the old contracts.
Right, and you anticipated my questions dealing, and so what is gained as a result of Act 10 and what's been lost as an act as a result of Act 10?
My short answer to summarize would be management flexibility.
Yes.
For people running schools is the biggest gain from their standpoint. And the biggest loss is keeping the revenue cap flat. I would break the Act 10 story into two chapters. Chapter one is what happened in 2011, had this civil war, tens of thousands of people demonstrating in Madison, national news of the first order. And a lot of what came out of that, Governor Walker would tell you billions of dollars have been saved and so on. A lot of that is true.
Yes.
Frankly, there was a pretty compelling evidence that fringe benefits of for teachers needed to be notched down. They'd gotten out of control, the price of health insurance and so on. But that's chapter one. Chapter two is keeping the revenue cap flat since then. And that's the chapter that's actually getting less attention, but is more important.
Okay. On that note, then, we're maybe down to our last half of a minute here. In closing, are there any other issues in urban education that you would like to comment on briefly for us?
Well, my biggest grief as someone watching the scene remains that so many things have been tried with so little success in changing the status quo in which kids who are coming from historically low performing populations see their performance and overall success go up. And somehow we have to work on changing that, which I hope would include working together much more than is the case statewide, and especially in a place like the Milwaukee area where the battles continue. Somehow we have to find solutions to this because the future of the state's economy depends on it.
Okay, on that note then, to our radio audience, we say thank you for being with us today as we visited with Alan Borsuk, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University Law School. Mr. Borsuk currently writes an education column for the Sunday Journal Sentinel. Alan, I wish you well in your work of helping Journal Sentinel readers understand what is happening in the Milwaukee public schools as well as in public education in Wisconsin. Yours is a most important endeavor for our students, our citizens, and our state. Finally, tune in next Saturday at 10:30 a.m. for another edition of Education Matters. This is your host, Dwayne Olson, thanking you for being with us today.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archived programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page. This year's Jazz, Rhythm, and Blues Festival at Kenosha Harbor Park is Saturday, August 20th. Rebirth Brass Band headlines, also New Blues, featuring Carly Sky, daughter of legendary blues artist Buddy Guy. Proceeds benefit the Mary Lou and Arthur F. Mahone Fund, promoting healthy lifestyle initiatives and educational and career opportunities for all students. Tickets at MahoneFund.org, a supporter of WGTD. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, WGTD Walworth County correspondent Jim McClure, and by Marlo Harmon, a lifelong Racine resident who's currently employed as an addiction counselor at Racine Correctional Institution. And now, here's today's host.
Good morning and welcome to WGTD and to our program, Community Matters. I'm Linda Fleshensky, the host for this week's edition of Community Matters. What makes a person want to run for elected office? What motivates them? What are the goals they seek for their district and its residents? Joining us today to discuss these and other critical issues are the two Democratic candidates who will be facing off against each other in the August 9th primary to represent